Welcome to this throwback edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. Today's episode was originally published in September 2017, but it's still perfectly relevant today as extreme weather season heats up and headlines about storms and death tolls cross our news feeds daily, regardless of whether the media chooses to mention the obvious impact of climate chaos. Sources today include Start Making Sense, Politically Reactive, On the Media, Counterspin, Decode DC, Popaganda from Bitch Media, and The Bradcast.
Well, Scott Pruitt, who Trump appointed to head the EPA, says we should focus on helping victims of the hurricanes in Florida and Texas this week and not debating climate change. I think you have a different view.
Of course the victims need to be helped. There's no debate about that. Mr. Pruitt is trying to sidestep his shameful avoidance of the overwhelming scientific message from the entire world scientific community that hurricanes like Irma and Harvey before it are made much worse by global warming. And this is simple physics. This is not controversial. Hot air holds more water. And what goes up must come down. So that's why you had, in the case of Harvey, the greatest amount of rainfall ever dropped in one place in the United States in modern record-keeping era. And likewise, Irma was the strongest hurricane ever measured coming out of the Atlantic. And the real scandal here, I think, is how so many people in the political world and the media world, frankly, are still letting the GOP, the Republicans, get away with this. To even have this conversation about it being, oh, this is insensitive to talk about climate change. Nobody said that, for example, after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 16 years ago this week. Nobody said, oh, we shouldn't talk about the causes of terrorism in the aftermath of 9/11. That was a lot of what we talked about, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
So it's the same situation now. But of course, the Republicans don't want to do this because they've all drunk the Kool-Aid about climate denial.
You wrote the book on global warming and climate change. Was there anything that surprised you about Hurricane Harvey in Houston or Hurricane Irma in Florida?
No, and this is what's so heartbreaking but also infuriating about these storms. We have been warned literally for decades that this is exactly the kind of extreme weather that global warming would intensify. In fact, going back to 1988, when the NASA scientist James Hansen first testified before the United States Senate and said that man-made global warming had begun, he said that these are the kinds of extreme weather events we'll see. And then in 2008, I covered and attended, actually, in Washington, D.C., John Podesta, who would go on to become Obama's transition director and who had been Bill Clinton's White House chief of staff. Podesta organized a so-called war game to try and test how the United States and other world governments could deal with the kinds of climate impacts that scientists were projecting. And here's the eerie part. The scenario that war game used, which was vetted as scientifically accurate by the United States' own scientists at the National Lab, here's what they envisioned. The scenario included a Category 4 hurricane in Houston, a Category 5 hurricane in Miami,
Wow. And
record monsoon rains and flooding in India and Bangladesh. Well, that's exactly, to the word, what we have seen in the last 3 weeks. That's why I say this is premeditated murder. We have known that these damages were going to come for years. When you don't act and instead you make the problem worse, which is what the Republicans have been doing, and I'm sorry to say too many Democrats as well in Washington, it's not that different from continuing to sell cigarettes. We know cigarettes cause lung cancer. And for reasons that escape me, it is still technically legal to sell cigarettes in this country. But we all, I think, would agree that it's morally reprehensible. We're in a similar situation now with climate change. The science has shown very clearly that these storms are going to come. They are going to kill people. If you don't do anything about that, that's premeditated murder.
Let's talk a little more about the media coverage of the hurricanes, which, of course, has been massive. We've seen those reporters standing outside in gale winds with water up to their knees. We've had those beautiful multicolored animated maps. We've seen the swirling images of the hurricane from far above and the weather satellite. We know an awful lot about these hurricanes now. What did you think of the media coverage?
I think the media coverage has been good on the ground. I don't think that they needed to do all the macho stuff about standing out in the storm to prove that they're courageous journalists. But I think that the coverage has been shameful in not talking about the cause of these storms. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that global warming was the only cause for these hurricanes. Obviously, hurricanes existed long before global warming. But global warming is making these storms much worse. And yet you do not hear that, especially in the TV coverage. The New York Times, Washington Post have run the occasional article talking about climate change's involvement. NPR also did a piece on that. But if you look at the networks, they did not mention climate change over the weekend, not once on ABC or NBC's coverage.
And I think this includes the Weather Channel.
Well, it's interesting. The Weather Channel is very, very cautious about all this. And there was an interesting piece, I think, in the New York Times that talked to the people at the Weather Channel about this. Why, when all of them are meteorologists, they all know perfectly well that global warming is intensifying this stuff, why aren't they saying that? Well, it turned out, which I hadn't realized, that the demographics of the Weather Channel's audience skew to the right side of the political spectrum. And therefore, they are censoring themselves. And this is the great scandal in the media coverage here of these storms. It shows that the climate denier campaign, which has been going on for decades now, is still working. It's still working, even though the science and we see with our own eyes what's happening. And it's working because even a channel like the Weather Channel is censoring itself because of a political concern.
Yeah.
This is not politics. This is also, by the way, what other climate deniers, a congressman from Houston said the same thing. I am not going to talk about the politics of this while people are in trouble. It's not politics, Congressman. It's science. It's the Republicans who have made this political by attacking Al Gore and saying that only leftists want to deal with climate change, which is so ludicrous from an international standard. Look around the world. Virtually every other government in the world, with the exception of North Korea, signed the Paris Climate Accord to basically get a handle on this problem 2 years ago. There are a lot of those governments that are far from left-wing. Angela Merkel, who is the Chancellor of Germany and arguably the strongest voice on this stuff out of Europe, she's a conservative government.
It's not politics, it's science.
What is environmental racism and what is environmental justice?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So, you know, it's actually three different terms that have been out there since the beginning. And I actually started the environmental justice movement as a student. And the three terms that were there were environmental equity, environmental justice, and environmental racism. And when folks talk about environmental racism, they're talking about the intentional sort of racial aspect of the impacts that are happening inside of communities, where they're placing certain things, or whether it's a landfill, or it's an incinerator, or a coal-fired power plant. There being that intentionality in that of, you know, trying to impact communities of color and indigenous populations. Environmental justice is a term sort of that everything kind of evolved into, because also when folks were talking about environmental equity, at one of the first meetings back in 1992, and there was an elderly African-American lady who was there, and she stood up when folks were talking about the three different definitions. And she said, well, environmental equity is definitely not going to work, because what we're asking for is not to be moving pollution around. We are actually looking for justice, and we're looking for the elimination of these impacts for any low-income white community or a wealthy white community or an indigenous community, African-American community, Latino community, so forth and so on. So then there was a big conversation that happened in that space, and folks decided on justice, on environmental justice being the term moving forward, and that's where we are today.
How do you see environmental racism playing out through Hurricane Harvey currently?
You see a number of different dynamics that are going to happen in this space. The first one, of course, is everybody's always focused on saving lives. And it's great to see so many folks have come together, both those who are in official capacity, those people who are volunteering, you know, to pull together and help save people's lives and help get them to safety. The real interesting dynamic is after this period is over and you begin to see a movement of people. Folks maybe had moved on, just like in Katrina, folks went over to Houston and to Baton Rouge and a number of places, and then they had difficulty getting back home and they had difficulty in finding housing. So one of the things you're going to see is that there'll be a dynamic that goes on here very shortly in trying to get people housed and, you know, getting people who have owned homes, get their homes back up. So the question will be, will there be disproportionate impacts to communities of color and trying to locate places to live? Will there be disproportionate impacts when the dollars, the federal dollars, start to flow? Will there be biases that will also take place when folks are looking for opportunities, the contracting and subcontracting opportunities as the cleanup goes on? Then you're also going to see some other dynamics. You're going to see dynamics in the environmental context of Superfund sites. There are a number of those that were flooded and pollution and sediment begins to move. And we all know that this current administration has been slashing budgets in relationship to Superfund work. So now there'll be priorities that have to be set and people will be making decisions about which communities will get cleaned up, how fast it will happen, at what level. And therein lies the rub, if you will. Will there be those disproportionate impacts in communities of color? And if so, will environmental racism be a part of that overall construct of the way people are analyzing the situation? I'm hoping that folks have learned the lessons from Katrina and Sandy and even the BP oil spill of how we have to be laser focused on our most vulnerable communities and helping to make sure that the right things are in place, to make sure that justice is a part of the process so that these impacts that happen even without storms, that, you know, we begin to address those. As the vice president the other day was saying, you know, now we're going to all come together, make sure that all of our citizens are protected. I hope that that actually does play out, because if it doesn't, then we will be looking at environmental injustice situations.
You mentioned Katrina, and Katrina has been on my mind a lot as well, just thinking about, since that was such a huge environmental disaster, and also just thinking about so many of the residents of New Orleans who were relocated to Houston after that, the idea they might be experiencing this again is very painful to think about. But from what you've seen so far, how has the FEMA response been? As of right now, do you see any improvement? Do you see the patterns repeating?
As it relates to the initial recovery, I think that folks have been doing a pretty good job from where I am. I haven't been down on the ground for the first time in 20 years. So from the folks that I've talked to, in the sense of people going out, going to people's homes, trying to make sure that someone's stuck on a roof or those types of things, it seems like that part has been pretty good. Katrina was a little different, where we had folks trying to cross bridges and people stopping them, those types of things. We haven't seen that type of a situation so far in relationship to what's been going on in Houston and Port Arthur and Beaumont. But the real rub, again, will be as dollars start to flow, as decisions are being made and priorities being set of how much folks are going to actually engage with vulnerable communities, how their voice will play out in the process. If there are sort of these gaps that exist, will they be filled? Will communities' voice also help in the disaster action plan that will be designed or already is moving forward? And as it continues to evolve, you know, how their voices will play out in that situation. So those are some of the things that folks have to, you know, pay attention to. And we're just going to have to make sure that there's real equity a part of this process, or folks who have been in these vulnerable situations, they'll just be doubly facing these challenges that will be in front of them.
I believe that disasters reveal society. They are opportunities for us to actually pull back the curtain and see what some of the deeper commitments and values of a society actually are.
So news consumers can expect to see themselves or their nation in the mirror of that coverage.
And that's often, I think, surprising to people because they think of a disaster as an apolitical event. We should rally around our community and not talk about politics. But disasters show us where people live, why they live there, and what kind of dangers they may face because of where they live. That's deeply political. Disasters reveal to us whether or not we've invested enough in our civil society. Do we have the kind of health care that we need? Do we have the kind of environmental protection that we need? And because disasters are so complex, it's all sort of revealed at once.
You've observed that conservative outlets tend to focus on the looting, the sense of panic, you say, a sense that we need strong law enforcement. And the liberals will say this is a flawed government approach, ignoring the needs of the poor and the disadvantaged.
It's predictable. The sort of partisanship is understandable, and it's understandable that the media wants to cover that. But what I like to see is a much closer look at local politics, particularly around things that may not seem so flashy, like infrastructure spending or zoning or the legacies of racial segregation, for example, the politics that actually matter in the midst of and after disaster, not whether or not the president looked presidential when he was standing in the rubble or in front of the firehouse.
As Congress begins drafting an emergency Harvey relief bill, what sort of rhetoric should we expect?
I think we're into a new period in American history here. Generally, discussions around relief have been opportunities for members of Congress to show convivial attitudes. You know, you have a senator from one part of the country joining hands with a senator from another part of the country and reaching across the aisle and drafting bills they can support one another. That held through Hurricane Katrina. With Hurricane Sandy, we saw something very different. The response from Congress was slow, partisan, and the vote that passed the final Hurricane Sandy relief bill broke along party lines. Critics of the bill were saying there's so many things in here that are pork, that are not related to the disaster. And that reflects, I think, a pretty consistent ideology of many conservatives who don't think the government should be much involved in infrastructure spending or science spending or health spending. A lot of that relief bill was focused on dealing with the deferred maintenance of the transportation system, for example, in New York and New Jersey.
Almost all of the bill, whether it was marked for infrastructure or science, had to do with repairing damage, direct damage.
Yeah, there's no evidence that the money that was spent was pork in any way, but that reflects an idea that I have that the government has a role in keeping our infrastructure in good shape, for example. And so what you'll see play out, I think, with the Harvey relief bill is that Democrats will want to see spending that can have a long-term impact on making the next storm less costly. The real thing to watch for will be fights within the Republican Party as to what exactly should disaster relief be. There is one ideological viewpoint that says that disaster relief should be sandbags and water and temporary shelter, and that's about it. Leave the rest of it to the churches, to the communities, to the city, to the local taxpayers, and maybe the state. There will be other Republicans who will take a different attitude, and that's how we will predict, I think, the size of the Hurricane Harvey relief. There's another aspect of this that's playing out at the state level. Houston is a Democratic city. The majority of citizens of Houston did not vote for President Trump and for the current governor. So you're going to see debates playing out at the federal level, but also at the state level about, well, does Houston really deserve all of this money and will it be well spent? Disasters are sort of a masterclass in American federalism. Understanding it in that way shows us, again, that disasters reveal the way we think about the welfare state, environmental protection, or economic growth.
You still sometimes hear things like disasters don't discriminate, or it's wrong to politicize a tragedy. But as we continue to assess the ravages of Hurricane Harvey, it seems like maybe we're moving a bit beyond that. Sure, we know no one ordered up a hurricane, but public policy and political choices do play a role, do make some disasters worse than they might be, and do leave some people more vulnerable than others. So media may be moving beyond nature. What are you going to do? But where will they end up? Because accountability translated through the corporate media machine often winds up just being blame. And blame and accountability are not the same thing. It's not a question of who to be mad at. It's about who has the power to make things different and what should they do. Media themselves are, of course, important players here. So what can we say about their work so far in covering this natural and not so natural disaster? We're joined now by journalist Neil DeMoss. He writes often about social policy issues for various outlets, including Fair.org. And he's author of the book, The Brooklyn Wars, and co-author of Field of Schemes. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Good to be here, Janine.
Well, we don't need to cram Hurricane Harvey into a comparison with Hurricane Katrina. They aren't the same. But in terms of media, one of the things that people remember, besides irresponsible and straight-up racist reporting around Katrina, was mainstream media discovering poverty and the combination of poverty and racism. There was a kind of a light bulb for a minute there, and media outlets promised that they wouldn't forget what they learned. Is it your sense, generally looking at the coverage of Harvey, that media have retained much of that purported lesson?
I would say that the media have retained a little bit of the lesson. I think the coverage has gotten somewhat better in some small ways and has not especially improved in some larger ways. I think you have not seen the kind of overtly racist coverage of, you know, people looking for supplies and calling it looters when they're people of color that you did after Katrina. And I think you've seen a little bit more sympathy towards the people who are trapped in this disaster. But at the same time, you know, what the lesson of Katrina supposedly was, again, for that 1 minute that the light bulb went off, was the realization that, oh, there are some people who, when faced with a disaster, can't just pick up and leave, not because they are afraid to or are too stubborn to leave their homes, but because they don't have the resources. And that's the kind of thing that you would hope that the media would be exploring more when you have another disaster of this scale. And I don't think we've seen an awful lot of that so far.
There still is this idea of a disaster as being an equalizer, when what it really does is call attention to real differences that exist, such that different people just can't react the same way. And one of the things that I know that you've been thinking about has to do with insurance, even as simple as that.
So there's been a fair bit of coverage about the fact that only around one-fifth of homeowners in the Houston area have flood insurance. And, you know, I was just watching CNN, and they were again talking about what is the government going to do and how are we going to address the fact that there's going to be a huge need for additional aid. Those are good questions to ask, but at the same time, are you also asking why people choose not to or, you know, can't afford to have flood insurance, are not getting it? And, you know, there's been some indications that, you know, one reason is that the National Flood Insurance Program has been running short on cash, both because of the series of storms that we've had thanks to climate change and more devastating storms thanks to both climate change and the fact that we have more sprawling development that is, you know, getting in the way of these storms. And then also on top of that, there's just underfunding. And, you know, President Trump has been talking about cutting funding for the flood insurance program, which would force them either to scale back on the flood maps that would enable people to determine whether they are actually in need of flood insurance, or if they went and paid for it out of the program's own pocket, then you would have to raise premiums and price people out of affording to have flood insurance. So, again, it's a complicated series of dynamics that you have to look into, and the coverage mostly has sort of stopped short of that, yeah. Right? You know, it's just been, oh, too bad people don't have flood insurance. What you going to do?
It's not that it's not sympathetic exactly, but if it doesn't go deep enough, then you sort of have to wonder, well, how sympathetic is it if it's not really going to get at the root of some of these problems? Like, for example, I've heard A few times I've heard that, oh, well, Houston doesn't have zoning, you know, but I haven't really seen it spelled out how that might affect impacts from something like this.
Right. And there's a couple ways, right? One is that when you don't have zoning, you can have a lot of sprawl into areas that otherwise possibly you shouldn't be building in because they are needed as reservoirs for water when you do have a flood. The other piece that there's been a little bit of coverage about is the chemical facility that's having fires. There's a lot of development of petrochemical facilities in close proximity to low-income communities in the Houston area. And again, there's been a little bit of coverage of that. Democracy Now! Has talked about it. I think the Houston Chronicle had some coverage of it before the storm. But again, these are things that are very easy for the media to start looking into once you have all this attention on Texas. And instead, we're largely getting, you know, the helicopter of the hour and, you know, let's see the latest rescue, but not actually talking to the people being rescued about what got you into this circumstance and what is going to prevent this from happening in the future.
Well, like you said, there was an initial investment in the mapping in the 1970s, and then there was a real lull between 1980 and the early 2000s. There was an assumption that once we mapped it, we wouldn't really need to map it again, and the funding was very low, so FEMA was having a hard time keeping up with the maps. So not only was it unable to map new areas during this time, but it was unable to update the very old maps that quickly sort of became outdated. So the funding did go up in the 2000s. It was recognized that the maps were critical. But like I said, there's such a backlog, right? This is a problem if you neglect policies that there was a lot to do. And so they used a lot of that initial funding in the 2000s to simply digitize the maps. So these were actually making digital copies of old paper maps that were based on outdated studies. What they weren't able to use or invest enough in is actual new engineering studies at the local level to remap the flood risk in communities that had, you know, in some cases pretty radically changed in terms of the amount of their development and therefore the flood risk associated with it. So as someone I talked to said, they are neglecting the cornfields and cow pastures, the places where on the edge of development that are probably going to see development in the future. And oftentimes those places are completely unmapped. So what this means is that communities can start developing in these areas, not knowing perhaps that they're in a flood zone.
Are we taking into account anything about like climate change or rising sea levels or hotter than average temperatures or, you know, are we looking at any of that kind of stuff? Because I got to be honest with you, you know, a huge portion of the planet is water. It's not going anywhere. It's just going to keep going onto land. Are we doing anything about that or do we even care?
I think some people care. We're not doing enough about it, in my opinion. And this is one of the things I'm studying is adapting to climate change. And these maps are very important for us to be able to do that. I would say that we're not doing that right now. FEMA's aware of this. They've started a new program that tries to have a more dynamic set of maps that can map future flood risks. But these are for informational purposes only, and local communities have to request them from FEMA. But it's non-regulatory. So it does not, in other words, it doesn't have any regulatory impact unless the local communities decide to use it to plan development in their floodplains and change regulations, building regulations in floodplains. So it is up to the local community to decide whether they want to use those risk maps or not. Some won't even probably request them. So the maps that we've been using and we continue to use for regulatory purposes, that is for the purposes of buying insurance, flood insurance, and also for the purposes of minimum regulations, floodplain regulations, are backward and static. So they are backward looking. They're based on historical data. They are static, so they are not looking to the future. So to the extent that any studies can pick up some of those early changes having to do with sea level rise and precipitation patterns, then the maps will slowly start to reflect that if we update them frequently, right? So that's a sort of a big if. They will capture, you know, sort of past events, but they will not capture future events unless we start using, you know, putting that into maps for actual regulatory purposes.
This strikes me. So basically what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you correctly, if you're taking historical data, you're trying to predict what's going to happen based on history.
Yes.
If you take future looking data, you're trying to predict what you think is going to happen in the future. I think that sounded very redundant, but necessary. So we're trying to predict a lot of things here when it comes to the issue of flooding and natural disasters. And for the purposes of this conversation that you and I are having, we get it right a lot and we get it wrong a lot, I think. You know, if someone says I'm in the 100-year floodplain and I don't flood for the last 300 years, why am I in the 100-year floodplain? Or take a city like Houston, Texas. You know, Hurricane Harvey just demolished Houston. Houston has been flooding basically every year since the 1800s, since it was founded. Why? Because Houston's a swamp. But we keep doing this thing with Houston. So, and here's the deal with Houston. 20% of Houstonians have flood insurance, 80% don't. How is that even possible from a historical perspective? Then looking towards the future, what you're talking about, trying to predict climate change, trying to predict where these storms are going to hit, shrinking beaches in Florida, shrinking communities, etc., shrinking islands off the coast of Maryland and Virginia and elsewhere, and in the Caribbean where we own some territories. You know, that seems to me that's just as unpredictable as whether or not history is predictable. How do we know these things?
Well, I mean, I think you've raised a number of really important questions. Now a flood like Harvey, right? People call it unprecedented.
And that's why we're seeing this unprecedented amount of precipitation. I mean,
we've seen nothing like it. It's a freak occurrence.
It rains and storms here often, but never quite like this.
And those are rare, right? They are rare events. But if we continue to talk about them as though they're just freak occurrences versus harbingers of what might come, then I think we fail to really realize the full risk of what we might be facing as a result of climate change. So it gives people a false sense of security. You have a line on a map, and if you're in it, you have to buy insurance. If you're outside of it, you don't have to. And that's not the way really nature works. And FEMA recognizes this too, and that's why they want to move towards different types of maps that aren't so in and out and give a kind of false sense of security and a false sense of understanding of risk.
Can we go back to Houston for just a second? If a lot of Houston is in the 100 or is outside of the 100-year floodplain map, but Houston flooded in 2017, in 2016, and in 2015, is the definition of a 100-year floodplain that you get flooded a couple of times in 100 years, once in a couple in 100 years, three times in 100 years? If that's the case, it sounds to me like it's not every 100 years. It sounds to me like it's every year. Maybe I'm missing something here.
Well, first of all, it's sort of misunderstood what a 100-year floodplain means or 500-year floodplain means. It doesn't mean that if you look historically back that you're going to find that this flood occurs on average once every 100 years. It's a designation that means you have a 1% chance in any given year to have a flood at that level or greater. So it's a probability statement. So I do think we have to stop thinking in terms of these 100 and 500 year floods. And in fact, FEMA itself recognizes this. There's a technical map advisory committee that has written some really good stuff about we have to move from these 100 and 500 year flood designations to structure specific risks. So that would take a lot more information into account. It wouldn't talk just about you're in or out of the floodplain, but what's the probability of this structure given where it is, given the history of how often it's flooded in the past, given its elevation, how it's been built. And that would be a lot more fine-tuned and fine-grained and a lot more useful for communities to understand that type of a risk. So I don't think we should hold our breath and wait for that type of map to occur, because that is going to cost a lot of money. Let's face it, that's a big investment. I think it's worth it, but that's an even bigger investment than just updating the maps that we use today, the type of maps that we use today.
This story begins with an earthquake.
I was alone. The walls were trembling. You can hear the building kind of move.
Last summer, writer and activist Bonnie Amor was in Quito, Ecuador, when the city was rocked by an earthquake. Bonnie was there in part to report on the aftermath of another huge earthquake that had struck the country in April, hitting the provinces of Manabí and Esmeraldas especially hard and killing at least 673 people. So when all of Quito started shaking under Bonnie's feet, Bonnie Amor feared for the worst.
You know, I remember this April talking to a friend who actually lost family members due to the earthquake in Ecuador. And I was just like, I can't imagine what it's like to just be walking down the street and the earth beneath you just shakes. It's just like kind of like unthinkable. So when it happened, I was just, I feared for my life. That's the first thing that I think, like, oh, shit, you know, I could die. This is the end. You know, you never know what's going to happen.
And then the shaking stopped. Bonnie wasn't sure what to do. Go outside and try to find friends? Stay inside alone? The choices were limited.
I deal with a lot of like physical disabilities that kind of like limit my movement and like my access to travel in certain ways. So at that point in August, like I could barely walk. I was having a lot of problems with my mobility. And Quito is like a city of diagonals. Like it's just walking up and down mountains. It's super high altitude. I was with my cane. So my friend's apartments that were like people were inviting me and stuff from my family that was like on the other side of the country, it just wasn't accessible. So I made a decision to stay by myself and sleep by myself. And it was, you know, I was light sleeping. It was really hard.
All alone, Bonnie was clearly upset and kept thinking about how it could have been so much worse.
You know, I'm shaking. I'm just trying to be calm. But, you know, my initial reaction was just crying. Because, you know, I felt safe in the moment. I didn't know what was going to happen. But I also felt like I had a lot of privilege and access that a lot of people who are affected by these quote-unquote natural disasters aren't.
Natural disasters. That's the phrase people often use to describe disasters like earthquakes, floods, and fires. We usually use it without thinking. But as Bonnie Amor points out, a lot of the devastation wrought in these situations is not natural. It's made by humans. In Bitches Chaos issue, Bonnie delves into this idea in an article called Unnatural Disasters, The Human Cost of Human-Caused Disasters.
And a lot of these places that are most targeted and most affected by quote-unquote natural disasters were like made environmentally vulnerable to those effects intentionally through environmentally racist policy.
While disaster can strike randomly, of course, humans often play a role in what we think of as purely natural disasters. Deforestation contributes to mudslides. The industrial process of fracking has led to a huge jump in earthquakes. Floods increasingly happen in areas along coastlines that have been eroded by human water management projects and oil projects. Low-lying areas are even more vulnerable to floods because of rising sea levels caused by climate change.
It just decimates the coast. And all of the natural kind of shore barriers that the earth has to protect the land from floods and stuff like that. People in coastal regions tend to be historically, you know, black and brown people in coastal regions historically were, you know, fisher folk working off of the land, subsisting off of small scale fishery and kind of living, working with the ecosystems that, you know, are, you know, part of their ancestral lands. And those people are, you know, the most marginalized. So we see these set of factors that come into play before these disasters hit, like commercial overfishing off of the coastlines. There's like these invasive industries, corporate industries, a lot of times illegal industries that come in and just take over the coast and of places in the global south. And that just really decimates the ecosystems on those coasts, making it more vulnerable to floods and things like that. So those people, that's environmental racism.
And in all disasters, the brunt of the devastation is borne by the most vulnerable people, the people who have the fewest resources to escape and who have fewer resources to rebuild. So-called, quote, natural disasters are not neutral acts of God. The very human components of color, class, and gender play huge roles in the chaos. In the relief effort after Ecuador's April earthquake, Bonnie and other organizers saw that many of the people most hurt by the quake, Black and trans residents of Ecuador's coastal cities, weren't getting help. Bonnie was among activists who fundraised to send money directly to the people and queer-led organizations that needed support.
People who needed stuff the most did not get it, and that's how it happens. That's how it goes.
As Bonnie points out in their article, Unnatural Disasters, these kinds of DIY efforts and small group fundraisers played a bigger role in the relief efforts in Ecuador than official government programs. The newspaper El País reported that 83% of the shelters that sprang up after the quake were DIY efforts. Another paper reported that 6,500 Ecuadorians were staying in official shelters, while 22,500 were staying in unofficial ones. In times of disaster, the most vulnerable people relied on each other and on their communities for support. The world saw similar dynamics play out with Hurricane Katrina. As researchers for the U.S. Geological Survey have determined, the coastal areas of Louisiana and Alabama that were hit by Hurricane Katrina have been made more susceptible to massive flooding thanks to oil and gas companies' rapid destruction of the native wetlands, whose mangroves and plant life are usually buffers between the land and the sea. A giant Army Corps of Engineers canal built to help the shipping industry also destroyed those buffering wetlands. And of course, the Bush administration cut the budget for levee repair, leaving the city's infrastructure vulnerable to, quote, natural disasters. All of this adds up to a clear picture. While the hurricane was made of wind and water, humans played key roles in its destructive impact.
What Katrina showed us was that it can happen in the United States, in a place where we have all these resources and all this access and the richest place in the world. And, you know, this is the country that uses up like the majority of the resources, natural resources in the world that leads to climate change.
It's undeniable that the race and class inequality in the region created an unequal dynamic in who got out before the hurricane and who got stranded in homes, on rooftops, and in hospitals without electricity or clean water.
If you had the choice to leave, you fucking left. And those people tended to be white and have money and have access to be able to leave and come back and rebuild.
The biggest place we've seen this called out in pop culture recently is, of course, Beyoncé's song Formation.
What happened at the New Orleans?
When she dropped that, like, those are the first words you hear and those first scenes that you see of Formation. It's like, shit.
Formation's video, if you haven't seen it, is full of scenes of a flooded landscape. Beyoncé reclines on the top of a New Orleans police car, marooned in a flooded neighborhood where homes have water up to their windowsills.
You know, going back to Lemonade, that was really, it was really like truth-telling because what happened after New Orleans?
Looking at the science of climate change, in the future, we're in for more and more disasters. Floods caused by wetland destruction and water management projects, droughts caused by agriculture's drain on aquifers, hurricanes made far worse by warming seas. We can't see these as just random natural acts. We have to think about the role we humans play in this chaos and how we can help each other survive.
We need to learn from it, you know? Us, the masses who are going to be affected by it. Now, you know, this new administration is going to be so much worse when it comes to environmental racism and climate change and contributing to that. And it's going to hit us. And we need to be kind of prepared. We need to learn from what didn't happen in Katrina. And like you said, we need to look at socialized, community-led efforts to prevent these things, to protect the environment in places where, you know, Black and brown people are living, and make sure that they're kind of in charge of their own industries.
I know you wrote about some of this a few days ago with Thomas Peterson and Joy Hassall in Scientific American, and an article headlined "What We Know About the Climate Change Hurricane Connection."
Yeah.
The field of attribution science, and help me if I'm describing this incorrectly, but the process of determining what, if any, effect climate change has on any particular extreme weather-related event, that field has grown considerably, as I understand it, in recent years. How long does it take to sort of conclusively determine the climate change fingerprint on events like Harvey and Irma at this point?
Yeah, so in our piece, we explain there are really two ways to approach that question, and one is just to talk about the fundamental processes, as we already have. We know that warming increases the amount of moisture and the amount of rainfall. We know that warming increases the potential intensity of these storms. We don't have to do an attribution study to say that. And so just as in the case of a baseball player who's taking steroids and hits more home runs during that season, we know that a bunch of those home runs were due to the steroids. And as Tom Tolles and I say in one of the cartoons in the Madhouse Effect, to say, oh, but you can never attribute any one storm to the climate change, or you could never attribute any one particular of those home runs to climate change, is a loophole that you could lose a planet through. It is a loophole because, obviously, in a statistical sense, we are seeing more of these extreme events because of climate change. And it's the same sort of attribution that led to a major settlement by the tobacco industry when there was a clear demonstrated statistical linkage between smoking cigarettes and people dying of lung cancer. And whether or not you could prove that any one person might or might not have died anyway is irrelevant, because you know that you've loaded the dice towards those things happening more often. Now, when people say, and you still hear this response, even by some of my scientist colleagues, when they're asked, you know, what role did climate change play in this event? And they'll say, well, you know, you can never attribute any one event to climate change. It's almost like a mantra. It's like they teach it in bad climate communication 101.
Right.
And it's just wrong now. The attribution science has reached the point where we can do a sort of post-mortem on a storm of this sort, and we can do parallel simulations with climate models, both with and without the added impact of humans on the climate, the increased greenhouse gas concentrations, and you can see, you know, did climate change make this event significantly more likely to happen? It's just as that approach was used to basically convict the tobacco industry for, you know, the death of millions of people from smoking cigarettes. We can say in a statistical sense that this event is linked to climate change in the sense that it was made several times more likely to happen by climate change. It's the same sort of statistical linkage that is used, you know, in the context of, again, the linkages, the medical impacts of pollutants and tobacco products.
Yeah, nobody says, can we blame any one particular cigarette?
We're trying to hold climate change to that standard.
Right.
Or at least some in our media are trying to. And it gets to the other part of this. Why?
We will get to that in a second. Well, this sort of helps us get there. Your explanations, I want to say, Dr. Mann, have been at Facebook and elsewhere very early after Harvey and then Irma, have been very helpful to many of us in the media on this.
Thanks.
So I will try not to torture you here, since you've written so much about this. I will give you just one of these quickly. Charlie Kirk, a right-winger at some outfit called Turning Point USA, tweeted, "Florida has had 119 hurricanes since 1850, yet this last one is due to man-made climate change." Obviously, he was being sarcastic there, poking at people like you. Your response to Charlie when they claim that people like you are saying hurricanes, this hurricane or that hurricane, was caused by climate change?
Yeah, so it's a straw man, right? What they're doing is they're putting words in the mouth of scientists, because they can't actually refute
the connections that we are talking about. So they pretend that we said something that we didn't. Mm-hmm. They pretend that we made a statement that, this is sort of the typical straw man. These scientists are blaming Harvey on climate change. They're saying that Harvey wouldn't have happened without climate change. Nobody is saying that. I haven't heard anybody say that. And no matter how careful we are in explaining that what we're talking about is how climate change is exacerbating the impacts of these storms. Mm-hmm. No matter how careful we are, and you referred to several commentaries we've written where we have been very careful and we've mm-hmm. been very nuanced about how we talk about the connections, but it doesn't matter. What they're trying to do, of course, is sort of muddy the waters, poison the well. The critics, fossil fuel funded front groups and the right-wing shock jocks that basically work as their facilitators, understand that these sorts of events really have the potential to hit home with people. When people understand how much damage climate change is doing now, then, that's a real threat to the forces of denial and delay. And so they go after it. And in the very much the same way, right, when, I'd like to draw the parallels between Superstorm Sandy and Sandy Hook,
mm-hmm.
okay? In the case of Sandy Hook, the NRA didn't want us talking about gun control in the wake of that terrible disaster where 20-something school children were killed. The mantra is, this isn't the right time to talk about it. When Superstorm Sandy wreaked havoc on New York City and the Jersey coast, again, this isn't the time to talk about it. We heard that echoed in Scott Pruitt's comments and Perry's comments mm-hmm. as well. This is a mantra. It's what I call sort of the doctrine of Sandy silence,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's Superstorm Sandy or Sandy Hook. The forces of inaction and delay don't want us to be able to use a teaching moment like this. And it's sort of like, a drunk driver crashing into a, telephone pole. And then, when the cops apprehend him, it's like, this is not the right time to be talking about my drunk driving. This is actually what Seth Meyers said the other day on his show. He said it better than I can say it. It was a lot funnier than it's going to be coming from me. But it's, it makes the point, right? This is ridiculous. This is absurd. And in any other, under any other circumstances, we would dismiss this sort of, reasoning out of hand. And yet, the media, as you note, have largely been cowed into silence by that sort of it's the working of the refs. The forces of delay and denial are working the refs, and the refs are responding. The media is responding by being silent.
They're responding. They're doing a good job of it. They don't even need to work the refs anymore. The refs seem to work themselves.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes featuring conversations between the Best of Left producers, as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support through our Patreon page or from right inside the Apple Podcast app. As always, you can keep the comments coming in by leaving us a voicemail or sending a text to 202-999-3991 or by emailing me to j@bestofleft.com. You can also continue the discussion by joining our Discord community, and there's a link to join that in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com.